Thanks, but I mean, my name is Richard Hollis, and I'm the director of a company, a cybersecurity company, consultancy located in London called Risk Crew. We do things like red team testing, penetration testing, and compliance to cybersecurity requirements for big, small, medium, all-sized businesses across Europe. Been in the, I think the other thing worth mentioning in terms of background to my remarks is we don't sell product, and I've been in the industry for about 30 years now. I'm an old guy with very white hair and a lot of war stories that I wished I didn't have.
Sounds good.
Big fan of the podcast. Thanks for having me, Bid.
Thank you, sir. So you mentioned been in the industry for over 30 years, and people that cannot see us, I look younger, and I want to say your experience
yes,
is probably
yes, you do.
So based on your years,
yeah, for people who can't see us, he looks a lot younger.
Yep. So based on your experience, what would you say is something people are not necessarily paying attention to about their personal cybersecurity or organizational cybersecurity and so on?
Let me start with organizational cybersecurity because it's what I do for a living. And yes, I've been doing it for a long time. And I think at this, you know, at my age, I look back at my career and my profession, and I'd look to see something fruitful. I'd like to think that we contributed and made a change, a significant change. But I, honestly, I think in terms of the biggest takeaway from somebody in my position who's been trying to help businesses with their cybersecurity requirements is that they don't understand it. Nobody seems to understand it. And there's a big disappointment. I've had a big disappointment with my industry that the cybersecurity industry in general is just not up for the fight. We're not geared for this fight. We haven't been. And it's clear to me that I'm starting to think we never will be. One of the biggest problems in our industry is our products don't work. Our cybersecurity products don't work. Period. End of sentence. Cybersecurity products and cybersecurity managed services, they just don't work. And there's a simple reason for that is because, you know, we all want to buy a product. We all want to go out and buy a product to secure our businesses from attacks. But, you know, frankly, the products were built 2, 3, 4 years ago against attacks that were significant then. And by the time we get around to buying a product, when a vendor goes out and manufactures a product, you know, he gives it to us. And that was for a threat that we faced 3, 4 years ago. So we're a step behind. We're always a step behind the threats. And our vendors sell us products that effectively then don't work. Best example I can give you a bit is ransomware. We're all just terribly afraid of ransomware, right? What is ransomware? It's malware. Do you know anybody who's not running anti-malware on their devices these days? 2, 3, 4 types of anti-malware, and we're still getting ransomware. Why? Because the malware signatures that we're buying from vendors, our anti-malware vendors, are from 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And by the time they come out in development and they've got R&D money that they got to push it out there, and we buy it. And we still get malware, we still get ransomware, and we think, well, why am I buying products that don't work? So that's my first issue, that our cybersecurity vendors sell us products that aren't fit for purpose. Ransomware, the best example of that. The other part of that is in terms of your question of, you know, us as individuals, I don't think we care about our privacy. You know, we sacrifice our personal privacy on our mobile devices for convenience. Always have, always will. You know, Facebook wants our data, we give it to them. They sell it, and, you know, then Facebook gets breached, they lose our data, somebody else gets it, suddenly our identity's cloned, and we just don't care because we like to use Facebook or whatever the social media platform is that we upload all of our personal details and they lose them. Yes, I'm very cynical about end users, you and I, just not paying attention to personal cybersecurity. We don't understand the risks. And if we do, we sacrifice them for personal convenience. And two, businesses just don't seem to identify. They don't understand that they need to articulate an appetite. What is my risk appetite? Cybersecurity is an oxymoron, right? There's no such thing. It's no such thing as a secure computer. Never was, never will be. It's always identify, minimize, and manage the risk. So cybersecurity equals risk management. And so whether that's a business or you or I on a personal level, we have to understand what our appetite for risk is. What's your appetite for losing your bank details or, you know, photos of your wife and kids and your family on vacation? What's your risk appetite for that? Because until you understand what you're willing to risk, you're never going to go ahead and invest the time and the effort it takes to secure your personal device. Same for a business. They don't understand, well, how much can we lose before it hurts our reputation or you know, with our clients or in, you know, our share price with the market. How much, you know, is too much? And they don't articulate, define that risk appetite. And so the first breach they have, you know, it makes them pay a hard price. So we don't know what we want in terms of cybersecurity. How much cybersecurity is enough? It's like, how long is a piece of string? It's different for every business, and it's different for every person. And that lack of definition leaves us all just doing nothing.
Right.
There. Does that get you down?
Yeah.
Negative enough for you a bit?
Yeah, it's quite negative. I like how you describe.
Yeah, there. Like, job done.
I like your description of how cybersecurity and basically any form of security is pretty much risk management. An analogy I like to use is your own physical security, the security of your house. Everybody wants to live in a secure and safe neighborhood. That's the first level, whereby the risk of someone coming to check your car door in your driveway is as low as possible. It's not going to be zero, because your neighbor could come check if you locked your car doors and steal something from your car.
Yeah.
But then you want to minimize that as minimum as possible. You want the risk of someone breaking into your window as low as possible. You want the risk of just a hurricane, just crashing into your house, to be as low as possible. So from the personal angle, I know some of the things you do relates to surveillance and cyber stalking. So what can you tell us about what you've seen regarding cyber stalking, just generally, over the years?
Over the years, what I've seen is it gets progressively easier and easier and easier year after year after year to, you know, in terms of people stalking, using, you know, devices to stalk other people, for whether that's, you know, ex-relationships. We do in a lot of time, donate time to give cybersecurity and anti-stalking lessons to people who've had problems with, you know, after a breakup, you know, or a divorce, and their spouse continues to stalk them. The problem is that our devices report on us, right? We buy devices, then be mobile phones, laptops, cars, you know, our televisions, our home heating system. We live in a world where everything collects data about its user. Everything collects data about its user. And unfortunately, that, you know, whether it's your, you know, your car collecting data about, you know, your GPS location or where you've been or where you're going to go to, and all that mileage and how fast you drive, and what route, what streets you drive, all that, your car picks that all up and reports that to a dashboard. And if somebody else can get access to that dashboard, they can track where you are, where you've been, where you, and then, you know, anticipate where you will be. So first and foremost, we have to understand that the products and services that we run on our devices report on us. They collect data on us. That's what makes them valuable. That's what makes an app valuable. How much data can I collect on the user? From their geolocation to their likes or dislikes, to the time that they start to use the device and where they use it, you know, to when they stop using it. Everything collects data about us. And that data, if it can be accessed by someone else, can absolutely understand the time, the place, the, you know, the latitude, the longitude that we are at for surveillance. Now, that can be used for very bad things, as you can imagine, and it usually is. But here's the thing I have. The problem I have, Bid, is why would we give that to any company? Why does any company need to know where we are when we, you know, look at the, you know, whether you're looking at an Amazon reader, you know, a reader book with that's logging what it is you're reading, where you are when you read it. Are you on a beach? Are you on a train? Are you in your backyard? Are you, you know, why is all that information important to the vendor who sells us that application to read an ebook on our laptop or our mobile phone? Okay, so until we understand that every single app, you know, and 9 out of 10 pieces of software that we're running collect user data, and that data, first of all, can be used by a stalker, can be used by, you know, for surveillance, but more importantly, somebody's making money off that. And we still haven't connected the dots between our the value of our personal data, where it's whether it's our GPS or our likes and our dislikes. There are companies that make, you know, millions of dollars off that. You know, Facebook, Google, what does Google produce? Nothing. Google produces you and I. You know, we're Google's data that Google sells, what we do, what we like, where we go on the web, everything. And until we connect those two dots, we'll never make the distinction. It'll always be a stalking problem. Because when companies collect data and they data on us and they fail to secure it, because they do, then we're going to have a bad guys can collect that same data, whether they're stalkers or they're hackers collecting that data for use of identity theft. We live in a world where our personal data is sacrificed for cash. Data equals cash. Personal data equals more cash. And companies know that. That's why Mark Zuckerberg's a billionaire, and you and I aren't. You know that if you get that in tech, then you're out to design that next app that's fast to market. All right. And what do you sacrifice if you're fast to market? Secure design. So, you know, the apps out there today that collect all this data, they got to be fast. They got to collect a lot of user data. And of course, fast to market means you sacrificed a design time to make sure that app securely, that you're designing and developing that app with adequate security to protect the sensitivity according to the data you're collecting on that user. And we're absolutely not. That is the problem. The best example of that, bid getting back to, you know, why cybersecurity products don't work. You know, cybersecurity vendors are getting hacked. RSA hacked. Look at Fortinet, just hacked. Why is it that these guys are struggling with the same problems that you and I are struggling in our businesses? They can't even protect their own business from getting hacked. And they're getting hacked because they're designing security products without security. They're not practicing secure by design. Oh, shame on them. If we can't count on our security product vendors to give us products that are designed securely, then how do we blame, you know, Facebook, or, you know, it's just yet another, you know, Angry Birds app that we download on our mobile device that reports, you know, what brand conditioner we use in our hair. Sorry, I can get carried away.
No worries. So this has been a problem from, I would say, the beginning of the internet, because the moment something is created or manufactured or developed, there's the initial problems, and then there is second order consequences. So just like with AI now, we're seeing that AI makes everybody more efficient. And then, of course, it makes the bad guys also more efficient. I read somewhere that most hackers have objectives that they go after. What would you say are some of the objectives from a hacker's mindset that they primarily want to be able to achieve, whether they are going after an individual or an organization?
I call hackers threat actors, and there's a variety of threat actors out there, people who find, you know, I said data equals cash. That's a fact. So any cyber criminal understands that personal data can be turned into, you know, identity theft can be turned into cash. All right. But, you know, when you look at organized crime, who might be looking for bank account details or financial details, but there's a lot more threat actors out there who could be looking just to steal the power from your computer, you know, to do crypto mining, to hacktivists, you know, who want to be able to deface it because they're against global warming or, you know, treating animals with fur. Yeah, there's millions of different ideas that, you know, there are different hacker groups. There's not one hacker. There are hackers who hack for the pure, you know, for the challenge. Can I get into this bank? They're not going to steal money. They just want to see if they can bypass a bank's security systems. That's the term hacking. It's not negative in its connotation. It's just somebody who finds a use for something that it wasn't originally intended for. That's, you know, that's why these life hacks are so great on YouTube these days. You know, hey, did you ever do, you know, you can store your spaghetti in a, yeah, anyway. but there are threat actors out there who want to take our personal data because they can take it to the dark web and sell it. There was 30 years ago when I started, you could go to the dark web and find, you could sell. If you stole a database with 1,000 people's first names, last name, their name and address, their date of birth, okay, you could sell that for about $1 a piece. So if you stole the database of 100, that's $100. You could sell that on the dark net. That was 30 years ago. Now it's free. You know, 30 years ago, you could, if you got somebody's 16-digit credit card number, and there's their CVE number, their first name, last name, their address, and everything, that was worth about $10 a record. Now that's like 10 cents. It's nothing to be able to see. And you buy databases out there of thousands of compromised credit cards because we've all been compromised. We've all lost our credit cards and hacks through businesses that we've given them to. And so it's all out there. So the value, the intrinsic value of that data on the marketplace, on the black marketplace, on the dark web has dropped down. That's because of supply and demand. I read recently that there are over 14 billion personnel records that have been stolen and have been publicly announced as being lost through mandatory disclosure forms across the world. 14 billion. Excuse me. I thought there was like 7.5 billion of us on the planet. So we've technically lost about twice the number of records than there are people walking around on the face of the globe. That's amazing to me. Okay, so the value of our personal data has gone down. So now what's valuable is what? What do you think is the most valuable traded commodity on the web? It's, and I'll jump in here and say, it's medical records. It's medical conditions. It's our DNA. Okay? It's our blood type. It's our dental records. We get into now, we're past data. Now we're back, you know, in terms of identifying us as individuals, you know, name and address and, you know, what's the name of your cat and where was he born? That's all gone. Right now, the high value data out there is databases with, you know, stem cell research, databases that have people's DNA in. And when you have these huge vendors out there like Ancestry.com who are collecting DNA and they lose it to a hack, can you imagine the value of that? That's where the money is. The more sensitive the data on people, that's where the money is. Okay, now flip over to the business side. It's intellectual property, right? If you're in pharmaceuticals and you got another Viagra formula, or if you're a car manufacturer and come up with a new electric hybrid, that new design, that's worth a lot of cash if I can take that from you and then sell that to a startup who hasn't had the time to sink into R&D. So all data is intrinsically valuable is my first point. It depends on the buyer. Right? You can say steal a database, getting back to my shampoo about, you know, who uses what shampoo. And you could sell that to somebody selling shampoo for profit. Right. So you understand who wants to buy that data. And that's where you find the value in it, whether it's intellectual property or credit cards or personal information, or as I said, DNA. Huh. I'm really worried about DNA. That's not good. I mean, it doesn't make you any more personal than that. That's who you are. That's not how you voted or you know, how you're likely to vote or what kind of conditioner you use in your hair. That's your DNA. That's your propensity to, you know, health and, you know, do you have a propensity for cancer or leukemia? You know, it is a very precarious, you know, slippery slope that we are on when we give our data away to companies who do not protect it accordingly.
So based on all of these descriptions and analogies, how would you say RiskCrew is approaching the issue of personal and organizational security online? How would you say your company is basically approaching the fact that nobody can reduce risk all the way down to zero, but at least we should be able to manage it?
No, that's it. And it comes from what I said earlier. So a company like RiskCrew goes into a client and says, hey, cybersecurity, oxymoron, no such thing. And a lot of companies don't want to hear that because they just bought the firewall and they spent £1,000 on it and they want to buy cybersecurity. So it's a certain transparency in terms of the strategy that I'd like to think distinguishes RiskCrew, who walks in there and says, no, there is no such thing as a secure computer. Never was, never will be. Okay, it's identify the risks, manage those risks to your appetite, get up, you know, minimize them to within your appetite, and get up the next day and manage it and do it again and again and again. It's a process. It's never an end destination. All right, to manage cybersecurity risks to an appetite that in the event that you are breached, it's not going to put you out of business. That's what we do. And then, of course, identify, quantify that risk to them. What is your appetite? Could you have a breach and lose $100,000? Yes, we could. Could you have a breach and lose $500,000? Maybe. Could you have a breach and lose $1 million? No, that would put us out of business. So once people understand, if I had a breach and the impact was over $1 million, we'd be out of business. We wouldn't live to sell flowers again on the internet. That's my job done, to identify, to give them their risk appetite and then help them manage the risks. So if they did have a breach, it would be within an appetite that they can live and fight another day. Because there is no absolutes, right? There is no cyber, there is no security. There's risk management. So the more you make them, and say, and there are some risks, you just accept them. Hey, you know, we all take risks every day. We cross the street, you know, with not at the lights. We take a risk of getting hit by lightning on a cloudy day. Right. We take risks. There's nothing wrong with that. I'd like to think what Risk Crew does is say, hey, just if you can't, You obviously can't negate the risk, then just embrace it. Put your arms around it and say, hey, I'm doing business today, and I know that if I had a breach, it could put me out of business. And that just makes you a lot more sensitive, and you start to see things when you have that sensitivity, right? You look at the threat landscape out there, and you see things like ransomware or cybersecurity products or things in a different, in terms of what will that return give me if I buy that product or hire that person or do that penetration test? What's the return to my risk appetite? And connect the dots like that, as I said. That to me is a very sophisticated, evolved customer who gets that. There's no such thing as cybersecurity. We just got to manage these risks and do the best that we can.
Sounds good.
And but your point to, you know, the evolution technology, there's always, now it's AI. You know, when I first started, I told you 30 years ago, it was, believe me, it was Bluetooth, the threat of Bluetooth. And then it went to Wi-Fi. Oh my God, Wi-Fi is unsecure. You know, then it was cloud. Oh my God, cloud secure. And it's always going to be like that. It's always technology first, security second, right? Because nobody starts with secure Wi-Fi. They just go Wi-Fi 802 and then they add encryption later and it's a bolt-on. Mm-hmm. Cybersecurity is always a bolt-on to any technology. So along comes AI, and who can work on both sides of the fence in terms of defense and offense, you know, can help a hacker break into a system and can possibly help a defender or business protect their system. So it's the first technology to come along that can be used for good and evil, you know, But I say this again, we always wait for security. We wait for the breach to tell us, oh, geez, we missed that. Oh, wasn't counting on a virus or that Trojan, or didn't see that supply chain connection as a threat vector, or, you know, hindsight is what. So I doubt we're going to see AI hacking before we see effective AI for use of defending, whether it's us on a personal level or our businesses. But no, hackers are—they're faster, they're smarter than vendors, because they can make money, right? They can make real money, and then vendors got to invest themselves in some AI technology, then put it on the market. And by the time it's on the market, it's old, and the hackers have moved on to something else because they're a step behind. Blah blah blah, and that perpetual circle of failure, you know, starts to reinstate itself. So I'm excited about AI only, you know, because the clock is ticking for us to get out in front and use it as a defensive technology. But we're already too late. By the time we start using the term on podcasts like this, it's too late.
Right. So you mentioned initially at the beginning that products don't work. And based on what you're describing so far, I agree. They don't seem to work because by the time the product is on the market, the threat descriptions have already changed. So how would you categorize processes, emphasizing processes as a way to make sure that security is efficient and effective versus just paying for products
But that's a great point. And that's where I live and breathe. That's my sweet spot. You know, I'm negative on products, you know, obviously, because we were all lazy. We want to buy a firewall and check a box and say, oh, we've got security. We bought a firewall, but it's not that firewall. If that firewall is going to be effective, it's the maintenance of that firewall. It's patching. It's the rule set. It's taking it off of default. It's constantly, it's the process associated with keeping that hardware or software at peak performance. And the same process applies to our businesses and us as general end users, you know, making sure that we're keeping on top of patches and hot fixes and updates and changing passwords and updating to the next version. 90% of the hacks out there that have that have happened back in 2023, last year, happened from vulnerabilities that were over 3 years old. And that means somebody, you know, a vendor said, hey, I've got a vulnerability, you need to patch it, but we never got around to patching it. And so then, bang, we got hacked. It is a question of volume and making sure that you're on top of that process. No, process is the key, and process isn't sexy. It's not romantic. It's, you know, it's system security administration. It's terrible. It's boring. It's hard to do. And the bigger the enterprise, the harder it is. Much less in our personal lives. You know, do you have all the updates for your installed on your laptop or your mobile phone? I bet you don't. Because I don't, and I'm a security, you know, paranoid schizophrenic, and I wake up every day and I'm never on top of it. I'd like to shorten the lead time between a vulnerability being exposed and me getting around to a patch. But no, you're absolutely right. Process is king. We have, you know, it's about, if I want to hack something, it's through people, process, or technology, right? I can go in through the firewall, but the process, you know, associated with keeping that firewall in peak performance is everything. Or I go through people because they're stupid. They're idiots. You know, you and I are idiots, and we don't change our passwords, and we are easily socially engineered. And so, no, but process is where the heart and soul of it is. And here at Risk Group, that's exactly what we focus on. It's not the firewall. It's the maintenance of that firewall. It's not your people. It's the security awareness of those people, you know, because and that takes time. But, you know, like I just said, do you know any business that has a cybersecurity budget and spends it equally in three parts? One, people. Two, process. Three, technology. No, 100% of that cybersecurity budget goes into technology. Let's buy the latest gadget, the latest sexy cybersecurity something, okay? And we neglect our process and we neglect our people. And that, so we neglect two out of three, what I call attack vectors. And then we just can't understand why our people are so stupid. And somebody just got social engineered again. They clicked on a link and we got ransomware. Yeah, well, that's called social engineering, and you got to teach your people and maybe spending a third of your budget. But I don't, you know, not in my 30 years have I seen a business invest equally in defending all three attack vectors, because they are. But the vendors, you know, we're raised as consumers.
Right.
So we want to buy our way out of this problem. We want to, here, buy this anti-malware, this IDS, this IPS. It's always something that we can buy to secure something.
Huh. Wow.
So I'm listening to myself, and I'm really starting
No.
Bring myself down.
This is really good, because like you mentioned, people spend money to buy everything, and then we hear on the news that the most expensive vendor gets hacked, which should tell us something, that it's not about the product, it's not about the technology you're buying. Even managed services get in trouble because they don't prioritize their own security.
Here's what you can do. Test me on this vendor and managed service. Go to Google. Well, first of all, go to Google and download a list of the top 10 managed security service providers. Then go to Google and download a list of the top 10 cybersecurity vendor products, okay? And then go to Google one by one and see if they've been hacked. See if they've been hacked in the last year. And I guarantee you, you'll find 100% of them, all of the top 10, all of the top vendors and managed service providers been hacked, which tells me what I told you before. They don't know any secret. They're struggling with the same problems we are. Okay, they're not shepherds. We shouldn't look to them for leadership. They're sheep. They're as lost as we are. They can't protect their own systems. RSA, not to name and shame, but RSA loses their code. So all of our RSA encryption products are crap. That's it. They're gone. What do? They come up with a new one. We buy it again. And, you know, and the circle goes on. So it's not, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's part of, I'm illustrating the problem. And they're not incentivized. If it were a silver bullet, can you imagine? Pardon me. Let me bring up one more thing. With absolutely no liability. All right. You get ransomware and you're running, why aren't we picking up the phone and calling out the people we bought the anti-malware for and say, sorry, I just got malware. I'd like my money back. Can you reimburse me for this ransomware? Because I bought your product, but there's absolutely no liability. You and I buy a product, and if we to stop us from getting hacked, and if it is hacked, there's no the vendor doesn't have any liability for that. There's no financial compensation we're going to get if somebody goes through our firewall and they send port through services through a port in our firewall that we're there that we bought that to prevent that very thing. We pick up, call the firewall vendor and say, hey, those services came through an unauthorized port. How is that possible? I bought this firewall to prevent that from happening. I'd like my money back, please. We don't have that conversation in this industry. So they sell us products that didn't work with absolutely no accountability, no liability. Hmm. I'll say this again. The ransomware thing just gives, it's a stone in my shoe. You get ransomware and you paid all of this money for anti-malware. How come we're not including our anti-malware vendors in this ransomware discussion? Because that's if you bought a flat screen TV, you took it home and it didn't work, you'd bring it back. If you bought, why is it that we buy anti-malware software? We put it on our devices, it doesn't work, and we just buy more. That's crazy. That's just crazy to me. And I don't know of another industry where that's acceptable. And yet nobody seems upset about it. We just buy more software. We buy more anti-malware. Now, best practices, run 3 or 4 types of anti-malware. Well, that's great for that anti-malware industry. How about just running one and it works?
So some of these problems, of course, has to do with people. And we all know there is a big gap in training, not to mention training budget, but that's another podcast entirely. So for
yes, it is.
For individuals and the way we approach our individual security and, of course, organizational security, do you think the ongoing skills gap has something to contribute? Because if there is a skills gap, there is people that can do the work, but employers are thinking they want to pay less so they can increase their margins, and therefore the people they are bringing on are the people who are not as skilled, but then they are occupying a higher role where they are exposed to sensitive code and so on. How much of the skills gap can you blame for everything going on within the industry?
I'm a guy who doesn't hold the same opinion most people do of the quote-unquote skills gap. First of all, cybersecurity, from a strategy point of view, this is not rocket science I'm talking about. You know, identify, minimize, manage. Now, you get into some of the technical skills like a security penetration tester, you know, who's got to look at a system, try to break in, and then identify the vulnerability, see if they can exploit for ingress and egress. And, okay, that takes a certain sort of technical understanding that's necessary. But anybody getting out of college these days has that technical understanding. What they lack is the business application of that standing. Okay, so it's a lot like, for me, I told you at Risk Crew, we're a consultancy. We sell brain power. We sell, strategy is what we sell. We do penetration testing. Some of the best penetration testers I ever had never did a pen test before on any other system, but they've got that creative approach. All right. They're self-taught. They were, hackers, quote, self-confessed, professed hackers when they were 12, 13. They have a natural, ability with technology, and they have an unquenchable thirst about, a challenge. There's no such thing as no. There's no such thing as you can't get into this computer. You just give me some time and some some Red Bull, and I'll show you how wrong you are. So I don't see the same skills gap everybody it talks about. All right. To me, I'm an old dog. You can see that. I hire young kids coming out of school, and all they look for is a glint in their eye. And I tell you, some of the best talent I've ever seen is driven by, you know, imagination and creativity and a technical competence. But it's just a lust. It's a, you know, you can see some people get technology. There's no skills gap there. You know what this, they're referring to is some sort of piece of paper that says they went through a, you know, a course for certified ethical hacker that took, you know, $5,000 and 6 months to do. And that's what you're talking right. about. And who can afford that, frankly? But something about to tell you, I've hired hackers that have absolutely no certificates or degrees. We're never told how to attack a system. They just had intuition. And they just said, let me run some scripts, figure out, do some reconnaissance, and I'll figure out a way in. Those are the best people on the market. And I tell you what, that's the people we're defending against. Do you think hackers, do you think threat actors, Russian cyber criminals go out and get a ethical hacking degree before they apply to a... No, of course not. So why do we, you know, why do we think that's going to put us in a better position? The skills gap is overstated. And certainly everybody says, oh, the industry's on fire. We don't have qualified people. I don't believe that at all. I think we're holding them back by making them, giving them unrealistic qualifications to meet. This industry is very young. And, you know, to find anybody with 10 years hands-on experience, that's an old, you know, old hand. That's an old wise man. And we expect that from, you know, people getting out of college with cybersecurity educations. Not at all. I disagree.
Right. The running joke is you need someone with 10 years experience, but then I forget the analogy, but yeah, it's something silly.
Yeah, it's a joke because it's true. You know, you want to apply to IBM as a pen tester, you know, forget it, because they'll give you a job description that no one can fill. And then you go to conferences and everybody's, oh, we can't find anybody good. I don't pay attention to that. I tell you, you just and nor do really good companies. Everybody's learning this thing, you know. Everybody's a work in progress when it comes to cybersecurity. This is not like carpentry where we've been doing it for, you know, a million years, and you know, it's not a tradesman. And we're learning this as we go. And there are hungry people out there who have some incredible skills, intuitive skills, and we're overlooking them because they don't have a piece of paper that says they're a certified ethical hacker or whatever we're looking for.
Right. So talking about AI. I feel like you would have tons to say about AI and all the craziness going on. So I'm just going to ask you directly, what do you think about AI and its impact on the current state of cybersecurity?
I'll be honest, I'm not trying to sidestep the question. I haven't come to a formal opinion yet. I'm looking at very positive things for the use of AI in terms of helping my clients with AI. And I'm looking at, you know, some very terrible things, some quick advances in uses of AI to compromise business systems and people's personal devices. But at the end of the day, let's not forget that A means artificial. All right. And no matter how good it is, it's artificial. It's running off of data that is mass produced and mass marketed and mass accepted. So we're at the early stages, and it's easy to see AI attacks in phishing, for instance. You know, they're good. They're much better than they started out with. And it's leaps and bounds better. But it's still artificial if you actually are doing phishing by hand and know the difference. So now we're going to cross the line where we're not going to be able to tell the difference between an artificial attack and an attack done manually by a cyber criminal in, you know, in Russia, for instance. And that'll be the day I hope I retire, because that'll be the day that I don't know what that'll do to the industry. To the industry, we're already outgunned, right? We have, let me back up and say, for instance, you know, it was about 15 years ago with Stuxnet and guys like Snowden that we started to think about nation states as threat actors. All right, so we got bad guys out there who have all kinds of skills and capabilities. We have hackers and hacktivists and botnet farmers and cyber criminal gangs. We have all these different types of threat actors with different capabilities, resources, et cetera. All right, but nation states came along: China, the U.S., France, Israel, Great Britain. You know, anybody with a major economy who puts their national resources against getting into a system. You can't fight that. It's over, right? It's over. You cannot defend your systems against an attack by the NSA or the Chinese. You can't. So that's, and I think of this, and it's like, remember when Crocodile Dundee came out, and they're walking, and he's taking his girlfriend, and they're walking across Central Park, and they jump out, and some guy whips out a knife, and his girlfriend says, "Give him your wallet, Mick. He's got a knife." And he says, "That ain't a knife. This is a knife," and pulls out that huge machete type thing. That's a nation states. There's just no competition, even with Russian cyber criminals who are out for the cash. It's a business. Organized cybercrime is big, big business. And that's putting your business up against another business that wants to get your data for money. And we don't understand that. So, but technically there's two threat actors out there, and nation states are in another ballgame altogether. You cannot defend your devices against a nation state attack. All right, now back to AI. Same thing. There's going to be a point where AI will give just the run-of-the-mill threat actor the capability of a nation state. And that'll be, unless we are able to step up and use AI to defend our systems and our devices in a proactive kind of way, not a reactive kind of way, everybody will have a bigger knife than us. Everybody will have that big machete, and we'll just be holding out our little pen knife and saying, "Keep away from our systems." So AI is bringing that on slowly but surely. I retired out of my profession before that happens, because as negative as I am, I still think, if you understand what's at risk, you got a chance. You can, you can protect your systems. You can protect your personal data or your business sensitive data to your appetite. But those days may be going when any yin yang out there has access to, a knife like AI to attack your systems that can intelligently identify and exploit vulnerabilities that you're not even aware of. It would be like going up against, the old Stuxnet type, where it's a multi-level attack that you couldn't put out that kind of fire, much less detect it. Your house would burn down before you even understood you had a breach. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we still have a chance to deploy AI defensively to keep all businesses from cyber attacks. But having seen our track record, no, security, product first, security second, I'm not putting any money on it.
So regarding this take on AI and how you don't see a way forward, basically, on using AI to leverage or enhance security, how about AI to enhance processes? Do you think that's something that could be done?
Yeah, there you go. Because we just said process is the silver bullet, right? If there was a silver bullet in our industry, it's process. Stay on top of your process. But I'm telling you, this is what I mean. But I don't see the use of AI for proactive patching. Proactive, now there are uses of AI that I see that are scanning systems and identifying vulnerabilities that, that may not be obvious, exposing, exposed to the exterior and fixing them before. That's great. That's great. That's the same idea. But to really be successful, it's going to have to be a 24/7 intelligent application that looks at interior, outer, outside, inside, and the use and how a user interacts, and anticipate. It's like the Minority Report. Anticipate a crime before it happens. Anticipate a breach before it happens. Look at at how things are moving. Wait a minute, we have an end user who's came in on a Saturday after hours. They've opened up the CRM, the customer relations management database. They're copying, they're opening up, they're putting in a pin drive in their device, doing that predictive, okay, wait a minute, bad things can happen here, shut it right down. Now that would be, that would be an AI driven, 24/7 use of something that would look after an end user to make sure an insider didn't walk away with customer management or an intellectual property or a credit card database. Okay. But the same thing can be deployed. Now, here's the problem is I don't see a lot of that thinking on the market, right? Let me get to the heart of my negativity. I don't think vendors are going to come up with the problem. Let me say it this way. Maybe, just maybe, it's kind of like an unspoken truth in our in our industry that cybersecurity vendors profit from the insecurity of computing. Let me say that one more time for myself. Cybersecurity vendors profit from the insecurity of computing. Okay, so maybe, just maybe, it's not in their economic best interests to come up with a silver bullet like AI. Can you imagine buying AI application once and never having to do any other security for your systems and your momandpop.com? So they're like the pharmaceutical industry, you know, who makes a lot of money when you get sick, selling you cold medicines for your sniffles and your sneezes, and you know, here's some more Kleenex, and here's some aloe coated Kleenex, and here's, you know, the billions and billions of dollars are made in that industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, treating the symptoms and not the cure, you know, and to me that is the cybersecurity industry. Would the cybersecurity industry sell you one pill to take, an AI pill, one software as a service solution, and you don't need anything else after that? I don't, you know, it's like a sci-fi movie for me. It's got to be one company who rules the world, because I, you know, that's what the free market looks like. You know, treat the symptoms, not the cure. And as I look at AI and say, hey, AI could be a cure or could be farther along the path of a cure than I've ever seen in my 30 years. Now, who's going to sell it? Because we got to, our industry makes money off of selling the symptoms. You need a firewall. No. You need an intrusion detection system. No. You need an intrusion prevention system. No. You need a sandbox. It's always something, right? It's always something. Buy this to be secure. Buy that to be secure. Oh, you got sniffles. You know, here's some anti-malware for your viruses. That's what the industry sells. You point, problem solution. You know, individual point problem solution, not a panacea.
Right. Wow, I feel like this conversation could go on for easily another hour, but in the interest of time, is there anything you would like to touch on that we haven't mentioned?
Thank you for that, because I'd like to end on a positive note. Okay, I'm sitting here saying, things are bad. I do think things are bad. I'm saying cybersecurity products don't work. Here's the solution to that. Ask for it. Okay. Last time I looked, there's over 5,000 big enterprise level cybersecurity solutions on the market, trying to sell to you and to me and to this business and to that business. And I'm telling you, they're selling us products that don't work with absolutely no accountability. The problem is we're buying them. Okay. So you want to change that? Be a part of the change. All right. Be a part of the change you wish to see in the industry. Like an Eastern philosophy. You don't like what you see, be a part of change. If you're going to buy a product and it's anti-malware, talk to your vendor and say, sorry, what if I get ransomware? Will you be accountable for that? Can I get some money back? Ask for more. And then, gosh darn it, demand more. Because we're not asking for anything at all. We're buying products that don't work, whether you agree with me or not. But here's the thing, you know, and then our systems are getting breached, so we're buying more products and those don't work, and so we're getting breached again. And all I'm saying is, you don't like that circle, break the circle. All right, talk to a vendor and say, I'd like to buy this product if you could give me your word that if I have a breach, you're going to help me, and then be accountable. It's like, you know, it's like buying that flat screen TV. You buy one, you take it home, it didn't work. Here's an idea. Take it back to the store. Take it back to the store and ask for your money back, because nobody's asking for their money back. Nobody's taking these products back and asking for liability, accountability, and I don't know, maybe it should work. I want my money back. We need a consumer revolution, like Ralph Nader did in the United States for safety with car manufacturers, you know, getting them to put a seatbelt in, you know, when it wasn't financially in their best interest to do so. We didn't have safety from Detroit and car manufacturers because there was no money in it. Right. It took, and people were going through the windshield at 30 mile an hour accidents until guys like Ralph Nader, you know, consumer advocates who got safety belts in cars. And now they're expected. Now, you know, safety in cars is the standard. So we have to take that first and, you know, push to that tipping point to say, hey, this isn't good enough. I want my money back. And until we do that, nothing's going to, we'll keep, why would they ever change?
Right. You mentioned the analogy of the safety seatbelts, and I was thinking of even the backup cameras for people trying to reverse. And then before, there was no backup camera. Turn and look to the back. But now, every car has to come with a backup camera. Because again, safety.
Unbelievable. I grew up in cars that had bench seats with no seat belts, and you could, you know, and seriously, I'm not kidding. You got in an accident and your head would go through a windshield. No shatterproof glass, you know, no shoulder harnesses, no, you know, impact airbags, none of that. All of this came from us starting to be sensitive and saying, why are people dying in small car, in these small fender benders? Unacceptable. Unacceptable. Until we go back to our vendors and say, this is unacceptable in our industry, we're not going to get any change. And make them and say, you can make money by selling me a secure, you know, a platform, a secure software as a service.
Wow. And on that note, thanks once again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. Sorry if I got carried away. I don't mean to preach, but, anyway, thanks. Big fan of the podcast, and I appreciate you having
thank
me
you,
on.
Sir. Thank you, sir. So hopefully next time we invite you on to talk about whatever else is happening, you'll be ready to join us.
I'd like to talk about my hair conditioner next, if you could have me on. I got some things to say about it. No, thanks. I appreciate it. But thank you,
sir.